bags of popcorn in the back of the room, but we should do that for the next one. And we're going to do sessions. All of those technologies that we hear about, that gets a lot of press coverage, HTML5, CSS3, all those web API, SVG, and so on. Well, I asked those guys to make some demos of those. It looks like there was a late werewolf session last night, and I'm missing one of my panelist participants, unfortunately. At some point, he will wake up and realize that he's late. Maybe, if we're lucky, maybe during this session, but I doubt it. And on that, I think I'm just going to let them do their session and do their demo. So it is meant to be enjoyable and fun. So, Frank?
Morning. My name is Frank Olivier. I work on Internet Explorer at Microsoft, and I'll be doing a demo of our browser without really using the internet. We're having some issues. I'll start off by saying you can keep track of what we're doing at Microsoft on Internet Explorer by going to ietestdrive.com. We've been releasing previews of our next rendering engine every 8 weeks. You can go to the site, and you can see with a very nice developer guide, all the various standards we've implemented in the past year or 2 years. Now, as you go through the list, you can see that we have quite a large number of standards we've implemented. We really love implementing W3C standards in no particular order, like HTML5, audio video elements, Canvas, SVG. WAF font support, and one of the best things about shipping a browser that has support for so many different new standards is seeing all the different sites that people build with that technology. So, for example, here's a site that is a band from Los Angeles, Las Vegas, and they have their old navigation as well that you can use, but they also have a new fun way to interact with their site. And it's a new experience that is completely just HTML5, CSS3, Canvas-based. I'll skip the video demo because we don't have much in the way of network connectivity here, but you can see that this is something different from what you've had in the past. And one of the nice benefits we have with IE9 is we render everything through the graphics accelerator on your machine. So every bit of the web page we render on the screen, that's all done through the GPU, which gives us a very, very nice performance benefit. It gives us a nice benefit in power management. And overall, it's a nice improvement over how we've done it in the past. We've very much realized that performance is the one feature that everybody seems to like. Another nice thing to see is on real-world sites today, the usage of some of these technologies is just skyrocketing. We keep track of what web developers do on the internet. We run queries to see exactly what technologies are in use. So, for example, on this page, if you want to see where the band's going to be in the future, you have a nice SVG map of where people will be playing in the future. And this is much nicer than going through a list of cities and various dates. And they're playing on Paris in March 19th, and I'll probably still be there by that point. Another thing we've seen that we find critically important is when developers started creating more and more complex sites with all these great new technologies, it becomes a lot more important for the websites to be written once and run anywhere. So interoperability is a vastly important part of what we do. And we really want to enable a web where people can run their sites once, they can have interoperability across browsers, and as you can see, it's quite good already, but we need more and more and more test suites to ensure that everybody has the same web, no matter what browser they run. In this example, there's a nice Flickr library that's connected to the travel guidebook, and you can go zoom around the world, and let's see if this works. You can go zoom around the world and go find different experiences that you want all around the world. So it's a nice usage of Canvas to go and just browse for experiences and vacations that you want. It's a very nice, very smooth way to enable new experiences that you already haven't seen before on the web. Last thing I should mention is we have been updating our preview every 8 weeks or so. You can go to iatestdrive.com. We have a beta that you can download. The beta is from September 15th. We also have a platform preview we've released last week. And we've added support for CSS3 2D transforms. So here's a nice Flickr gallery that you can zoom in on the photos. They have a little bit of a rotation to them. And you can see all the various standards at work here. You can see our color management support using ICC color profiles. You can see WAP font support underneath the photo there, and 2D transforms applying to the photo. So we're very, very excited about all the new experiences people will be building on real sites out there. You see a lot of it in use today on the web already. It's amazing to see how the web is changing in a very short amount of time. If you have any more questions, if you want to see any more demos, I'll be happy to show you more of Internet Explorer 9 at the break. Thank you.
Thank you, Frank. Håkan?
Perfect. Yeah. Can you put my thing on the screen? There we are. So I'm Håkan Lee with Opera Software. 3 years ago at the TPAC in Boston, I talked about how web fonts can change the face of the web. At that point, we'd been using Microsoft Core fonts that came from the 1990s, great fonts, good stuff, but we'd been using them for 10 years and we wanted something else. And it's great to see today, due to the hard work of many people also in this audience, that we now have web fonts interoperably implemented. By adding two lines of code in your CSS style sheet, you can actually use a bunch of free fonts out there. And all browsers now support the same font formats, that's TTF, and also the upcoming WOOF compressed font format, which is being done inside W3C. So this is great stuff. I mean, you're not going to use all of these, you know, you're not going to write your CV in this font, right? But it's still useful for effect, for visual variety, which I think we need to have on the web. Going also a little back, you know, CSS, we can do a lot of stuff. Just starting CSS 1, you can set fonts, families, style, borders, colors, backgrounds, etc. Text Shadow was in CSS 2 from 1998. It hasn't been used much until now because it wasn't implemented in IE, but now it is. It's also supported. We can actually start using text shadows. We don't have to use all these image programs to make effects like this. CSS3 border radius. This was a request that came in actually very early in the CSS1 days, and I remember working with Bert in Sofia Antipolis in the early days in 1995. I said, you know, nobody's ever going to want rounded borders. You know, rounded borders, that's so 70s. I mean, who's ever going to do this on the web? And boy, was I wrong, because a lot of people want to do this. And, you know, now we have it. It's in CSS3. It's interoperably implemented by all browsers, I think. And you can do a lot of cool stuff with it. You know, just by changing a few values here, lines of code here, you can create visual effects. Of course, it's only fluff, right? It's not important. It's not semantics. But this is what people like. People like beautiful pictures. We need to communicate through aesthetics here. So now we have this one, at least. Also, more shadows, not just text shadow, box shadows. This is also stuff people spend hours and hours doing in Photoshop, which you can now do in one line of code. Here's a real example. This is what you get when you go to apple.com. You get this menu at the top, right? And it looks pretty good. It has rounded borders, a little bit of shadowing. It has text shadow underneath the letters here. But it comes down to your browser as an image. You don't have to do that anymore. You can change. You can recode that whole menu in CSS3. There's no images used to create this menu. Here I'm highlighting some of the things we do. Rounded borders, box shadows, and web fonts. You can replace a whole bunch of images on the web. That's really what CSS is about. There is actually one image on this page. That's the Opera logo here. At the bottom. But hey, we can do that in CSS3 as well. This is a bunch of div tags, about 10 of them, and we give them a roundedness and some color and some gradients. And you can actually do this logo entirely in CSS3. And I'm sorry, Microsoft, sorry, Mozilla, you're not going to be able to do your logos as easily. OK. Another thing that also works well is, let's see here, I lost my, can you see that? Is it on? Oops.
Okay, it's back.
I don't see it on my screen now. Can you see it now? Okay, there we are. So here's media queries, another thing that works. You know, this is my homepage. I have a little room here. I put a border on and stuff. And then I add media queries. And I say, when the screen is narrow, I apply a different style sheet. I don't have that room for the border anymore. So, and I don't put text next to each other. And then if you go very narrow to a phone-like thing, you know, this is powerful stuff. You know, use it with care. Moving over to HTML5, we have web forms. We have more semantics, everyday semantics into web. I'm sure when you order your tickets to go to Lyon to make your hotel reservations, you all had to go through a form like this, right? You put in a name, you select a date, etc. This is now easier with HTML5. You can say, you can add a code, an attribute, autofocus, and required to the tag itself. You say, this is a required field. You can style it with CSS. The movements here is also done through CSS3. This is transitions and transforms. Pretty cool stuff. It doesn't change the layout at all. It just lets you do visual fluff again, but it looks pretty cool. But here is semantics, actually. Autofocus and required. And that's important. Here's a menu item. I list the things I can select. Mister. Age, I have a range here, starting at 40, but I can go up and down. So this is things that the browser will know about and can help you. It can help you add your email address. Check in. You know, there's so much, how many hours have been wasted in the Western world trying to make these date pickers? Firstly, you waste lots of hours writing them using all sorts of crappy code. And then you waste all these hours trying to select a date. You know, it's so much easier, this one. You just add type date to the input field, and now the user agent can make a date picker for you and optimize it. A mobile phone, of course, is going to be different from this one I'm showing here. And the range also, also another thing that you should be able to do very easily. So we have it now, and it's implemented, and you can try it out. One more page here. This is showing web fonts at the top, selectable text. There's no images on this page either. I'm also showing multi-column layout here. This is text with logical flow, and I can select it. The heading here, Norway, is actually a spanning element. For those who read the multi-col specification, I think we have the first implementation of spanning elements in CSS3. This is a closed build, unfortunately. It's a labs build. We hope to release this very soon. This is not an image. This is SVG, scalable vector graphics, and I'm making him do the flip-flop using CSS3 transitions. The national anthem here is a small little script creating SVG, but it's based on the ABC little notation for music. So you basically write in C, D, E, F, G, etc., and then you create beautiful, beautiful typeset music. This is video. This is the next battle. Really, we need to find a common format for video on the web. And Google spent $100 million buying this format, WebM, and I think this is it. We had to make sure all browsers support this video format. We need to make video first-class citizens of the web, just like fonts have become it now. Yeah? Yeah? Good. Okay, 1 minute. Last thing. Printing. We must not forget about printing. This book came out in Germany 2 years ago. This is Wikipedia. They've taken the Wikipedia articles from the web, selected a few of them, 20%, taken the first three sentences and created a book from it. So we've reversed the flow of information. In the beginning of the web, we had to type in information and scan it to get stuff onto the web. Now we're doing it the other way around. We're taking stuff off the web. We want to print from the web. That's important. So CSS3 has this paged media module where we can do footnotes, we can do multi-column layout, we can do indices, we can do cross-references, we can do crop marks, all the things that printers need in order to publish books. And my prediction is that 2 years from now, half the books on New York Times bestseller list are going to be formatted using HTML and CSS in print. It's happening. Soon. Okay. This is important. This is important. Gutenberg, 500 years ago, not far from here, this man invented the printing press, and it totally changed the landscape. Europe was a backwater place before we had the printing press. As a result of the printing press, we had the Reformation, we had the Renaissance, we had the Industrial Revolution. So this is all due to being able to distribute information easily. And if we had one of his Bibles here today, we would know how to use it. We could turn the pages. We know how to read it. We might want to have a different font, but there we are. So this is the perspective we need to look at this in, 500 years perspective. I'm not sure, you know, Apple, Google, Opera, Mozilla are going to be around as organization 500 years from now. But I know that the Twitters we make, the Wikipedia entries, they are going to be around. So we need to make sure that our standards we create can last for that long time. That's the perspective we need. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. So this thing is on clearly. That's good. Let me see if I can. All right, so we're gonna show some flashy demos containing lots of fluff. So like Håkon mentioned, video on the web is really important and we need to get it working. And here's one demo showing video as a first-class citizen. By the way, all of the flashy stuff here is done using CSS transitions. So here is video interacting with the web page. So you can just use normal HTML. All of this font stuff is just normal HTML text layered on top. You can click on it and using CSS transitions, we can have things move around. In this corner, if it loads, it slowly loads. It's a video, trust me. And it's clipped using SVG clipping. So in Firefox, you can now use a lot of the SVG CSS features like clipping and effects and filters directly on HTML elements, such as this video tag. So here is another example. This is a video of a drive-thru in Dubai. But the cool thing here is because it's a normal video or it's a HTML video instead of a plugin video, we can now interact with it using JavaScript and using other technologies. So something I can do here is I can rotate around as the video is playing. And this is done using WebGL. So we're taking a video and projecting it into WebGL and allowing the user to interact with it. And so I can show you how this is done. If I go and I turn off CSS for this page, this is actually the video being displayed. So what this demo is doing is it takes parts of this video, projects it into 3D using WebGL, and then allowing the user to interact with it. So speaking of WebGL, one of the cool things, and we're going to show a bit more of this, the fact that we now have hardware acceleration and integration with the very powerful graphics cards that exist in computers today is we can do things like real-time fractals by moving all the calculations. That should be bigger.
Full screen.
All right, the zooming here isn't working properly, but OK. So this is real-time fractals for all the math nerds like me. It's pretty impressive that you can do this in a web page today. This is all real-time calculated. Same thing with ray tracing, fully real-time. So here it's not using WebGL in the normal sense, but we are using the graphics cards to do all the heavy lifting and all the calculations. All right.
So there's been a lot of discussion. You know, we've talked about downloadable fonts and downloadable fonts formats. I wanted to show. I wanted to demo an experimental implementation of support for OpenType font features, because now that we have downloadable fonts and web authors can provide those fonts, we can start to use a lot of the features that many fonts have that might not have been available in the standard 10 fonts that you were previously able to use in web pages. So in this example, you're looking at essentially some text here, but the font, this font actually has features that let you change to using proportional numerals and change to automatic fractions. So if you're formatting a recipe, you might not want it to look like this. You might want to use features in the font so that you get something that looks more like that. Similar things you can, if you have tabular data like this, you might not want the default numbers in the font because it might have better numbers that are suited for tables, and CSS should give you the power to select tabular numerals so that all of the text in the table lines up nicely. You can also, if you want, use old style numerals. You might like that. You can also access all sorts of fun features within fonts. This was essentially a replication of a demo page for all of the features of this font, but now all done within CSS. So now I want to hand this back to Jonas for one last demo, which is going to combine some of the WebGL stuff that we talked about with an experimental implementation of the audio API, for which I believe there's an incubator group currently working on audio data APIs that allow you to get data out of audio elements that are playing in the browser.
So this is a demo that was created by some people that was doing this audio API for us at I believe a good portion of them were at Seneca College in Canada. Oh, one thing I should mention: there's going to be some flashy effects on the screen, especially when I'm going to skip ahead a little bit in a second. And so people that are sensitive to that, please be aware about this. So this is all WebGL. It uses the audio tag for all the audio. There's going to be later, we'll see integration with video tags again. This is also integrating with services like Flickr to download real-time images from the web. It integrates with Twitter to get text into this demo, as depending on how much time we'll have, we'll get to see. Okay, I'll end up having to skip a little bit here. So here is a video element that we projected into the 3D world. All of this rendering is done using WebGL. And here we can see the audio API in effect. So what we're doing here is we're playing the audio, we're pulling out the audio data, and using JavaScript, we perform a fast Fourier transform to do a frequency analysis. as well as beat detection. So the audio is flashing to the beat of the music, or the lights on the buildings there are flashing to the beat of the music as it's being detected in real time using JavaScript. And all these images are downloaded from Twitter, I believe using a Firefox tag. The text on this Jumbotron is downloaded from Twitter. So this is all real time on a normal Mac.
Can you just cut the sound? You can use it. Oh. All right. Thank you, Donas. So I guess I'll take two or 3 minutes if anyone has any questions for our participants on their demos. We have one. Please state your name.
Doug Shepherds, W3C. This is not a question, but first off, awesome demos, all of you. Kudos. With the audio stuff, I just wanted to plug the audio incubator group, and we're looking at starting an audio API working group to standardize the audio stuff, reading and writing to the stream.
Actually, someone from the audio incubator group will be on the on the next panel.
Oh, okay. Dr. Cutler from Chevron. That music notation that you showed, Hakim, how rich was that? The music?
You're talking about the musical markup language.
Yeah.
The musical markup language is ABC. It's a simple notation, and I can show you the source code here. It's quite simple. If you can project the...
I mean, there's a lot of things that's involved with music notation, you know, like spacing of staffs. And,
yeah.
Does it include all that stuff, or is it...
Yeah, it includes a lot of it. If you can, if I can project my screen.
Yes.
Yeah, there we are. This is the source code for the music. This is the two first bar of our very patriotic national anthem there. I mean, we haven't changed the ABC at all. This is something that's been going on as sort of a project, and I think Wikipedia are looking to do it. They do a lot of anthem stuff. I don't think, I wouldn't, you know, do Beethoven's complete works in this language, but certainly for sing-along songs, this is very useful.
Hi, Claudio Venezia from Telecom Italia. This is very nice. I would like to know if you plan to address some augmented reality use cases in the near future. I mean, rendering graphical stuff on top of camera view and towards some context-aware web stuff.
The big missing piece right now is pulling data from a video camera or a microphone into a browser so you can interact with it. And there's some work going on that. There's the device element that's in the WattPG drafts, and I believe that there's been people experimenting with that. There's a whole lot of issues around that, so it's a very hard problem to solve, especially since we'll likely in the sort of integrated into that, we'll want to do things like streaming video, so you can do peer-to-peer chatting with video. And so we're trying to solve all of that. It sort of is an integrated system. Work is being done on it, but there's a lot of work to do. But we definitely want to do it.
And again, the HTML.next session is also going to have a panel participants on the device element. And so your question is also appropriate, is actually highly appropriate for the next panel. Last question.
Maybe I could just tell you that music notation is very complex, and there are two programs that are commonly used. One is Sibelius, and the other is, I've forgotten, it's the one Finale. And one of the very irritating things is that there is no standards-based notation way of exporting from one and importing into the other that actually works.
Yeah. And they're proprietary formats as well, I believe. So I'm not saying that ABC is the right solution here. You know, I'm saying that with a little bit of markup and some JavaScript and generating SVG on the spot, you can do wonderful things on the screen. But obviously, we're not tied to the ABC language here. But I think it as a demo, it works quite well. And I'm quite sure Wikipedia can do all the national anthems of the world using it.
Okay. I don't think that Roger was suggesting that WC is going to be responsible for making sure that those two formats can be converted from one to the other. I hope not.
Somewhere in the world, it would be nice if some standards body were providing some sort of standards-based music notation. I mean, probably the W3C isn't the place. Somebody likes the idea.
Well, I mean, okay. I don't want to go into a discussion. Should we go into a music ML?
Very briefly. Sorry, PLH. Very briefly, the guy who does music XML is active in the audio incubator group, and we actually have talked about standardizing that, but it depends on member interest, obviously. So,
okay. So at this point, I'd like to thank our demonstrators. Thank you, David, Jonas, Frank, and Håkon. That was great. And Paul is going to come and introduce the next panel, which is we've seen one working. Now we're going to talk about what we still want to have deployed out there and in the future. Thank you, everyone.
Can I get the other panelists up here, please? Chris, Larry. So you ready to go? Okay. So why don't you just take a seat and all in. So according to my calculations, Philippe, you owe me 12 minutes. So we stand between you and lunch. Lunch is supposed to start at 12:30. I'll ask the question now so I know the answer. Lunch is W3C? Where's lunch? Is it next door? Can somebody find out for us so that we actually know the answer to that? At the end of this session. My name is Paul Cotton. I'm co-chair, one of the co-chairs of the HTML Working Group. Michael? Thank you, Michael. We'll have a primer for lunch, right, Michael? So this session was put on the technical plenary agenda to try and answer exactly the kinds of questions we got from the previous session, which is, let's have some discussion about where HTML might go in the future. So we have four speakers. I'm not going to spend a lot of time introducing them, but to lay out the timetable for you, we had about 75 minutes. We have just over an hour now. I'm going to give each of the speakers 10 minutes, and I'm going to try and limit the questions to about 5 minutes after each speaker. The order isn't going to be identical to the way it is in the program. Patrick Dengler is going to go first, followed by Adam, then Chris, and then Larry Macinter is going to be the fourth speaker. And Larry has a series of questions to ask the audience, and we're actually going to try and do a cross-cultural experience here. And we want you to engage your IETF backgrounds, and we may do some humming during Larry's session. Yes. To see whether we can get some sense of the room on some of the questions that are part of Larry's talk. So without further ado, I'll ask Patrick to come up, introduce himself, and start us off.
Hello. I'm Patrick Dengler. I tend to talk loud, so I'll step back a little bit from the microphone. If you can't hear me, let me know. I wanted to kind of look into where we're going next for HTML. And I started writing this paper, and the paper's actually posted. And the thing that I caught was, first off, what an amazing amount of technology that's in HTML5 today. I mean, look at what we just saw. I remember HTML 3.2. I remember working on tools that's generating this stuff. And now we're seeing what we just saw. It's just so fantastic. And so, you know, I use these words as a tectonic shift. I don't not even know if I'm allowed to use that word, but developers have so much more to engage. They have so much more to learn. At what point do they say, this is the stack of technology that I'm going to rest upon? And that's what I'm trying to figure out. That's what I want to engage the conversation on. I don't remember ever posting a paper that got so much response before I talked. Positive, negative, so here's the time to come at me. What I want to kind of talk about is, as I looked at the functionality, that I believe that there's an opportunity for us to finish HTML5. And let me kind of say what I mean by that. I don't mean that it's just HTML5. I believe that developers think of HTML as a lot of different technologies that are coming together. I think of it, I mean, I was talking to folks, CSS is not a part of HTML, SVG is not a part of HTML. Well, you know what? From a developer's perspective, CSS is in almost every page of HTML, and given the elections that are happening now, I wish SVG was in all those so I could, you know, hover over those maps. So we have an opportunity here in the standards committee to take the existing technologies, bring them together, establish a plateau, and in parallel, continue with innovation. So what I think we need to do is form a consensus of what are those features that are coming together now. Which modules in CSS 3? Are we done with SVG 1.1, or is there more work to do to figure out how it integrates with HTML? The demos that Mozilla did where the filters are covering. What is it that we need to finish? Can we agree that these are the modules that we have to land on such that developers can depend on a consistent platform that's interoperable, has high quality because our specs are high quality? So that goes to, what do we do? Well, we have some alignment to do within the group here. And these are, again, Patrick's opinions. I'm not sort of making statements. I want to engage here. What does it mean to have this, like, transitions that already exist in SVG and now being developed in CSS? Why can't we institutionalize those conversations? They are beginning, but the communication isn't where it needs to be. We are growing that. We want to make it happen. There's filters. There's transitions and animations, and that is versus declarative animations in SVG. So it's this wealth of technology. Can we find that plateau, again, just like was in HTML 3.2, just like was somewhat unnaturally reached in HTML4. What are the features in HTML5 that I, as a developer, can depend upon across browsers? Currently, when you develop for a browser, and I did this with some demos for IE, you know, I'm not saying that we're immune to these problems, but when I develop, when I go to different browsers, checking if it works is not a sanity check. It is a development effort. We are sort of, I believe that we owe to the developers more testing. And this goes now to, what do I see, what do I want to see in terms of finishing that plateau and moving that into HTML6? It seems to me that there are a lot of fantastic engineers here, but we don't apply the engineering practices that we have and bring them into the standards committee. We typically, I would think that we all work from scenarios and use cases, and that we drive engineering through test cases. Why aren't we doing that? Why doesn't every spec have use cases that I can do a sanity check and say, have I gone too far? Am I looking at feature creep? When do I stop? It's the typical stuff that goes with projects. What's the end timeline? And who else is going to align with me? Does it make sense for HTML to stop here and CSS to continue and the alignment of SVG to continue? What can I depend on? And why can't we bring those engineering practices in what we're doing today? And that means also, I'm not talking about stifling innovation. There are a lot of opportunities that exist today with vendor prefixes, with fallback. We shouldn't stop that. Can we parallelize the stabilization and the innovation? So, in order to do that, again, I think that we have to take a set of features
that developers are demanding and prioritize them accordingly. Look at the set of technologies that are either in candidate recommendation or in last call and say, here's the line, let's do a fast force push with specific project timelines such that we can, as vendors that deliver this technology to developers, can stabilize and make sure through rich test cases that all of these are interoperable so it's right once to the ubiquitous web while the continuation to HTML6 happens. I suspect we're going to see a lot of great technology in terms of what we might do. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about finding date-driven feature sets for what HTML6 is, so cross-working groups, we have the right communication channels, we possibly have feature-specific working groups in order to deliver that. So that's sort of what's in my paper. I encourage you to read it, and I'm happy to take any questions, or do you want to take questions at the end?
No, we'll take them now if you're done.
I am done.
Are you going to the mic, Jeff? Yes. No.
Interested in the way that you lead with stability. So it's pretty common in software, and I guess standards are like software, or maybe they are software, that after you have a release with an incredible amount of function, the next release is called the bug fix release. So lead with stability. Are you basically saying that that what's next is basically bug fix?
A little bit. I think that your notion of like a spec is an item that you ship, right? And there could be this dot release. But the thing I don't want to do is I don't want to spend years doing that. I want to see this hyper focus on doing this. So what tests do we need in place? You know, everybody has their different tests. You know, I'll be honest. At Microsoft, we test every assertion in those specifications. So can we as a community lead with that and in fact maybe go back and look at those, but definitely when we look at HTML6 specs, let's lead with test-driven specs so we don't have to experience this dot release next time. But yeah, can we do that dot interoperable write once release that's short? I want it short. I want it like 6 months. Can we do it then? We have the technology. Where are they incongruent? Where are they incompatible? Let's start those processes and prioritize there.
Next speaker.
Yeah, Dan Glasman, Disruptive Innovations. I have a comment about, it's in fact a question, about finishing HTML and fast-track closure. In CSS working group, for CSS2.1, as I said yesterday, we have roughly 20,000 tests. It took months and months and months to make them, to debug them, once we're still on it. For HTML5, you will probably require 100,000, 150,000 tests, roughly. It will take roughly 2 to 3 years to develop them and debug them and review them. I don't see that as a fast track. I mean, you're not going to finish HTML5 until 5 years. It's impossible.
It's a great point. If you think about the number of assertions that are in these specs, if we look in hindsight, very difficult to sort of fill that gap. So I think some thinking needs to be done. At what level do you think about that interoperability for HTML5? I don't disagree. You can't review that many tests at this point in time and find that fast-tracked closure. But could we do it on a scenario base? Could we start there? Could we say these are the type of things that people are going to do and build tests for those instead of like looking at a tiny little assertion this time? And then as we move to HTML6, if you do test-driven development on your specifications, then you don't have to hit this along the way.
I don't think so. We have experience shows on the web that when shit has to happen, it happens. If you expect that the web designers are not going to establish correlations between the deepest features of HTML5, CSS, and SVG, and look at the edge cases of each specification, you are wrong. They are going to do things that you do not expect and that we do not expect in tests. And users will expect the correlations to work on the web. So you cannot extract a scenario of the best use cases that will cover most of your specification. It doesn't work. Interoperability has to be really deep. So you need all the tests to show interoperability.
So can I actually respond? Because I think I hear a thesis in your presentation that I disagree with. I was chairman of the XML query working group. which generated a test suite, and we have current members of the working group in here so they can give us the current numbers. But that test suite has well over 20,000 tests in it. It was done on the backs of volunteers inside the working group. So I'll agree with you that testing is very important. We need to make it a first-class citizen in what we do at the W3C. I'll also agree with you that you probably can't do it with the current resources. So we need, actually, the more important question is, how do we get the resources to actually do it? All right, so I'm trying to repeat for maybe somebody on IRC will write this. The speaker is actually agreeing with me. I think we have a big problem in front of us, but to say that we aren't going to do it is the wrong approach. We should be having a dialogue about how we're going to do it, because it's absolutely mandatory. Yeah, sure.
I don't disagree with that. In fact, I fully agree. Resources are a problem. I mean, in the CSS working group, we tried to engage the community to write tests for us. It doesn't work well, because it requires a lot of knowledge, a lot of time, people are busy, it's extremely complicated to write rendering tests. So I guess you have exactly the same problem in HTML. Given the number of tests, the workforce required is huge, but my comment was not about the test or the workforce, it's about the scenarios. Extracting profiles of tests that are, let's say, the topmost tests that interoperability requires doesn't work. Users are going to go deeper than that. That's all.
Do we have anyone else that wants to come to the mic? All right, then I'll go on. I'll thank Patrick on behalf of the audience, and we'll go on to the next speaker.
Just give me a minute. So, hi everyone. My name is Adam. I work at Ericsson, or at Ericsson Research. And I've been asked to talk a little about the device element, and why, can you ask? Because we've been doing some prototyping in this area during the summer. So, to start with, I don't know how many of you are that are familiar with the device element. I'll skip the first bullet and jump to the second here. The device element is really it's an element that represents a device selector, which allows the user to, in a secure way, allow a script on the page to access devices that normally aren't available to web developers. So, and a key thing here is security. It's a mean for selecting a device, but the key point is security. And it should really be shouldn't be like a yes or no question. You really need to pick a device. That's been a key requirement. And why do we need this? We don't need this in the native application space, because I mean, when you install Skype, for example, you implicitly allow Skype to access your webcam or a microphone because you know it's a telephone application. So. But in the web, you don't really know what you get when you click on a link. It could be evil.com that wants to record you and post you on some nasty video blog site. So if I jump back to the first bullet here, how did this start? It started in a mail thread on this public device API mailing list. It was a thread called UI for enabling web camera access from restricted content, something. And there were several suggestions on how to do this with the UI then. Toolbar buttons in the browser Chrome. There was like a device drawer where you drag and drop devices onto the page and you allow them to be used. There was also this info bars, familiar from like geolocation questions and yes and no. And there was also this device well. And the device element is really, you can say, the product of this, or the realization of this device well. It's something in the page that allows you to select devices. So, and it was thought that the input element wasn't kind of sufficient in this area because, like, selecting a live stream isn't that well suited with the form submission model. So, the conclusion was a new element was needed. So, device element is really, it doesn't enable video conferencing or anything advanced like that. It's just the first step of selecting a device to make it available to the web page. So, and there, then after that, you need an API to kind of handle the device. And this API is, of course, very dependent on the capabilities and properties of the device, device that you selected. So, there's only one such API described at the moment, and that's the Stream API, which is how you handle cameras and microphones. So this slide kind of shows the workflow when you use the Stream API. So first of all, up to the left, the device element is in the page. The type is set to media to filter out any unneeded devices. So what I expect here in the device list is microphones and cameras and such media-oriented devices. And then when the user clicks this dialog or this button or whatever it will be on the page, the device element dialog pops up, and the user can select the device. An event is triggered on this device element. It's currently called, it's a change event. So then you get the data. The data property on the device is then the device that was selected. In this case, it's a stream. So I set that to my stream. So what can I do with this? I can show it in a viewfinder. That's the example to the left. I have a video element, and I set the stream to the video source. And I can also, if you follow the arrows going down, I can record what the stream is currently recording. So, and I can do this at the same time as well. I don't have to do either. I can have a viewfinder. I can record it. So, what does this? What can you do with this? It brings a lot of new possibilities. The things shown in the last slide, obviously you can upload videos to a video blog without ever leaving the browser. If you're confident enough you don't need to do editing, then you can actually do that. And the other point is adding kind of communication to a game. This second point, it's not sufficient with the device element and Stream API yet. You need some way to share streams with other browsers. And currently there's a suggestion called Connection Peer, which allows you to do just that. Yeah, you could do a telephony application with the same stuff and augmented reality. And from the last presentations we saw, obviously do have some video, I mean, your webcam stream rendered in some cool WebGL 3D environment. So, we did some prototyping during the spring and summer at Ericsson Research, and what we wanted really was to have two browsers communicating with conversational real-time audio and video, and we wanted to reuse all the stuff that was beginning to be specified. So we used the device element and the Stream API. We wanted to render everything in media elements, obviously. And so we did like a device element implementation. It doesn't have a UI. It's just a dead link, just an element. But we solved that, so we include a JavaScript file in the page which kind of searches for all the device elements and puts in a UI created in with HTML and CSS. This is very insecure, but it's very convenient to modify the look and feel of this device. This is the below. You see one example of this is a media. The device type has been set to media here, so you're allowed to choose both audio and video. So, and the resulting stream is a composed stream with two components. And we also had to do some registry to map between the stream URLs and the actual media pipelines in the background to be able to play these streams in the media elements. So when we had the streams in the browser, we could like render a self view. The next logical step was how do we get the stream to the other side? And there was nothing in the specification at that time. Today there's connection peer, but at that time there was nothing. So we kind of invented something that we called the media stream transceiver. It's a long but very descriptive name. And it uses WebSocket as transport. So this is a screenshot of a very, I think it's like a 50 line video chat application. And we've done a YouTube video showing this as well. And these are the kind of the plastic toys that we used for. It used to belong to my manager's children, but we have adopted them now to the office. Yeah, okay, to sum up, obviously the device element will enable a lot of new use cases. I had a list with four bullets, but the list goes on. But there's a lot of work to be done before this is real. So to name a few examples, if you allow a web page to access your camera, how do you revoke that in a safe way? I mean, if it's the device element, it can perhaps be removed from the page. And what happens if you change your selection when you have a video conference set up and you kind of click the device element again and don't allow anything? So, and the result from our prototyping work is that we want to contribute with Coda and what we have learned to the specifications. And that's it for me. Questions or applause?
Are there any questions? You are a real quiet group. So you've done. I'll ask a question then. So you've done some testing with this. So where is this in the W3C today? Can you just reiterate that to make it clear to everyone?
Where this is, that's a good question. But it was originally in the WattVG, and I think there's a spec in W3C as well. I can't really tell you right now where it is, but
can anyone else answer the question for the audience?
Dominique Adelmacio, WCC, staff contact for the device APIs working group. So Ian Ixon came up with this device element and submitted to the WWG. He brought it up at some point on the device APIs mailing list. I think there was recent discussions on restarting this work formally as part of this working group, but this is unclear yet, I guess, is a summary.
Would it be in the charter of that working group automatically, or does it require something more than that?
It is definitely in scope for the charter. It's more a question of getting the editor resources and agreement.
Okay.
Is this on? Yeah, good. Just to
Could you identify yourself?
Oh, sorry, Robin Bergen. I'm a chair of the DAP group that Dom was just talking about. Just to insist on what Dom just said, the group is happy to take over the spec. It's a matter of agreeing with HTML and the editor of the specification about where it happens and how we publish it. So we can move ahead with it.
Tim Berners-Lee, you said that this should be important thing about it was that it should be secure and allow the user to understand what to control access to, for example, cameras and microphones. Does this mean then it should, in fact, should it be in within the web page where it can be simulated by any sort of markup, or should it be a drop down piece of real estate which is not fishable?
That's a good question. Several of the initial suggestions were to have this as a part of the browser, like the UI of the browser. But you could also see it as if you compare it to the file upload, where you kind of press a button and you get the old familiar file selector, where it could be something like that. So that's it's kind of an entry in the page, but then it's up to the browser to take over the rendering of the actual selection. So it should be familiar to the user that this is not something rendered by the web page. It's something done by the browser. But yeah, that's where I think the security risks lie, where pages trying to trick the user to enable the camera. So.
Hi, Dan Appelquist, Vodafone and the Tag. Just to reiterate, I think what Robin said, I think that, or maybe amplify it, on the topic of where this belongs within W3C, clearly from my point of view, this belongs within the Device APIs Working Group. If only because that is the group chartered to work on this, but also because for all the security and privacy issues that you've touched on, it really belongs in the same body of work where they're also thinking about those issues quite deeply and along with all the other APIs into other parts of the device, such as the accelerometer and other bits like the contact book, et cetera, that all also have privacy and security issues. Thanks.
Can I ask a question while you're there? So I'll ask the provocative question. If this is an element that's in the HTML language, why wouldn't it be done in the HTML working group?
Why would it be done in the HTML working group?
The HTML working group owns all the elements and attributes that are in the language.
Well, there's a lot of stuff that happens in HTML that is actually specified outside of the HTML working group, so.
I'm just trying to generate a debate here, okay?
I just don't think it's where the expertise is, frankly.
Well, okay, that'll be an interesting debate as well.
Is this where the blood starts?
It's flowing over the counter here, yes. All right.
Thomas Ressler, W3C, speaking with a little bit his head as the other staff contact on device APIs and a little bit with his head as TNS domain lead. Another case of expertise and all those troubles with the HTML5 working group was RDFA, and the way we attacked that was to have joint deliverables. I propose that either we've got a little death match between Robin and you, Paul, here, or a little lunch conversation about how to actually get this thing into a spec that actually makes it out in time.
Yeah, so I'll respond. One of the things that we reported to the AC yesterday was that the HTML working group is about to be rechartered. I think we need to put all of these kinds of things on the table during that discussion and have the consortium just make the right decision. I'm going to close the queue now because we're going to have to move on. I'll go to the back microphone first. I believe that person was first. I might be wrong.
David Rogers from the Wholesale Applications Community. I think it's probably folly to put everything in one working group, the HTML working group. You know, there is specific domains of expertise. I think obviously it needs to hook into things that HTML are doing. And clearly there's a strong liaison between the chairs and the members of those working groups anyway. You know, we're looking at using device APIs in widgets, and the way that we do security policy is actually quite a lot different to how it may be done in the browser. So you know, I think we don't have to put everything in one working group to be able to work together. We have one organization to work together.
No, I want to make sure it's really clear. I didn't say anything about APIs. I said it's an element. The Web Apps Working Group owns the APIs. The HTML Working Group owns the elements and attributes. So your point about wanting to use the APIs, I was not inferring at all that the APIs belonged in the HTML Working Group. Do you understand my distinction?
Yeah, I understand your point. But obviously the security and policy aspects are sat within DAP at the moment. And clearly, you know, it's more of a liaison function to you guys than maybe we just need to work closer together.
Yeah. Okay. Last speaker.
I'm Jeremy Orlo. I'm with Google. And I'm actually going to say the opposite thing, that I think this pretty clearly doesn't belong in the device APIs. I think the camera access is a good example where there's actually two APIs for the camera. One is kind of designed with the more policy security, type security and privacy model, and one is much more is something that actually will make it into web browsers that has security kind of baked into the API. And similarly, the file writer and file system were recently switched over to web apps because I think the group. The way that device looks at things, you know, looking at stuff that would integrate into widgets, the APIs just end up being fundamentally different than the types of APIs that we're going to see in web browsers. So we're definitely going to be pushing hard for it not to go to DAP, I think.
I have two more speakers left, so if you can put this in 140 characters.
Yeah, I can put it in one word. Bullshit.
Thank you. All right.
What you just heard is a lie. The APIs that are developed in DAP are developed with security baked in so that they can work in the browser. For some people, for some reasons, some people are under the impression that it's not the case, but it is the case. Thank you.
All right. Frederick, if you'll permit me, I'm going to go on to the other speakers so that we actually have time at the end for more questions, okay?
We're done at the end of my session.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Well, if what I would suggest is if you have points to make or questions you want asked, type them into IRC now so you'll remember them. All right. That gets them into the view of everyone. And if we have time at the end, then we can have some more questions. All right. Our next speaker is Chris Lowe. Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. I've encouraged all of the speakers today to create a BOF table for each of these topics. So I'd like to, if you weren't aware of this, I think Jeff mentioned it at the top of the day. There's a sign-up board immediately out to your left when you leave the room. So when you do leave the room at the end of this session, if you're interested in continuing these kinds of dialogues on any of the topics, go find the BOF table. And there'll be an identification in the meeting room, in the lunch area of which table you should go to.
It's a MacBook Pro dongle for the projector here. Does anyone have a spare?
Does anyone have a MacBook Pro dongle for their laptop?
Huh? New generation.
New generation, please. No backwards compatibility implied. Thank you, Norm. I think, well, keep yours in your hand, Norm, because this one's not working. So while we're getting set up here, I'm going to do the cultural adaptation here. Can this side of the room close your lips and hum? All right, stop. Can this side of the room close your lips and hum? Can this side of the room close your lips and this side of the room I'm pointing to, my right, stage left? All right, thank you. All right, so can this side of the room out hum the other side of the room, my right? Louder, please. All right, can this side of the room do even better now, the other side of the room, the left side? All right, so now you're all warmed up. We're gonna use this capability at the end of Larry's talk.
During
Larry's talk. So you're great hummers.
The audio.
Ready to go?
I don't know. Looks good.
It's about as good as you're going to get, probably. Oops.
Let's go outside. Yeah. What a pain. Okay. I'll do my best.
Okay, sorry about that. So my name's Chris Lois. I'm here with representing the Audio Incubator Group. There was a little bit of mention of the group before. I'm with the BBC, so the demos I'm going to be showing you have not been implemented by me, but by some other people. But I'll try and redirect any very technical questions that I can't answer to the right people. So the charter of the group is we mentioned exploring the possibility of starting one or more specifications dealing with various aspects of advanced audio functionality, including reading and writing raw audio data and synthesizing sound or speech. And I think the best way of showing what we're trying to do is with a demo. So this is a demo created by the people at Mozilla. In the latest version of Firefox, but it's illustrating the principles that the whole group is kind of working to.
Whoa.
Sorry. I knew this was going to be a problem, live demos. So hopefully you can hear a little bit of music. If not, just imagine your favorite song. So the question is, what if we could do more than just play the audio?
Turn it up just a bit more.
If I plug it in, I think it's gonna... Thank you. And so what we're doing here is we're accessing the samples that are in the audio through JavaScript and displaying them on the screen. So the API gives direct access to the raw samples in the audio. And so what we can do is take those and visualize them. For example, is this waveform. And we can also apply some effects to them. Here's some a low-pass filter with some various settings that have been modulated in real time. So the important thing to note about this demo is that all of this audio processing is happening in JavaScript. So all of the spectral analysis, all the FFTs have all been implemented in JavaScript.
Chris, can you just turn down the sound a bit?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, okay, right.
This is not an easy thing to demo.
Yeah.
And so there's some libraries been implemented for doing DSP in JavaScript. So we can do various things with that. So here's a visualization of the FFT. And if you do some transformations on it, you can turn that into a kind of, Winamp style visualization. And if we filter out just particular frequencies, where we're expecting the bass drum to be, for example, we can do some beat detection. And I think you saw that flying around the strange planet earlier on, so this is the original prototype for that. And here's one of the first prototypes using the 3D canvas element.
So I just want to give credit there to these people who produced this demo. So as part of the incubator group, Chris Rogers at Google has come up with a proposed API. Now, one of the tricky things, one of the complications that came about with the technology that Mozilla proposed was that all of the processing had to be done in JavaScript. If you're doing a single FFT or something in real time, you can manage that. If you want to do something a lot more complicated, it may be that the performance isn't there yet in the JavaScript engines to do that. So at the other end of the spectrum of things that have been proposed in the incubator group is this proposal, which uses a concept of nodes. So on this diagram, we have a streaming source, which would come from our element, from our audio element, and we pass that into a gain node. And then on the other side, we have some one-shot sources, some samples that we can pass through various filters. So the idea is that the browser themselves would implement the idea of the nodes and the code, the processing that needs to happen at low level. And then the application developer in JavaScript, say, could configure those nodes and chain them together. So as an example, I'm not expecting to go through the code, but the idea is that you can create nodes, and then if you see the connect method there, you can connect nodes together. So you can build up this graph of processing. And again, this is for the one-shot sounds, where you've chained together a low-pass filter, a panner, and a gain node together. So there's currently two implementations. So the implementation of this API is in the WebKit, in a branch of the WebKit source, and then there's also the code that uses the low level uses the direct access to the samples through JavaScript, which is in Firefox. And both teams are kind of working on adapters that let them try each other's proposals out. So that's one thing that the incubator group is working on is to come up with, decide what the best approach is, and then whether or not we can come up with some technologies that link the two different approaches together. So I just wanted to show some demos, if I can, from WebKit. So it was mentioned earlier about the music XML. So one of the people who's been involved in the incubator group works for a company called NoteFlight. And he's built his company does online notation stuff. So he's quite keen to see this kind of thing implemented. So he's built this this demonstration, which the score is rendered in SVG, I think. But it also lets you play the sound as you go. So this I think his company sells desktop software, but they're looking to move on to the web. So you can do things like change the size of the note heads, and then the text will reflow on the fly. And then the sounds that you can hear are being generated with the node-based approach. So notes have been synthesized on the fly, but there's no real effects processing happening to them. They're just being generated and played. We can just increase the tempo there. And one last demo, if I can get it to load, we'll see. Here's an implementation of a drum machine. So it lets you add notes as you go, and then each time the cursor is passing over these notes on this matrix here, the sound is being generated. We can change the bank of sounds that we have. And we can also apply some real-time effects to the using controlling the parameters of the nodes that are linked up to the individual events there. So I just wanted to show you demos from both camps that both teams are working on. So that was Joe Berkowitz, the first one, and Chris Rogers did the second. So ongoing work for the incubator group. We're continuing a survey of use cases to inform the API development. It's kind of why I'm involved from the BBC side. We've also got Joe involved, trying to come up with categories. Well, I think we'd like to talk to people with in the device groups and in the accessibility groups as well, try and sort of formalize our use cases. And there's an ongoing debate about how much processing can or should be done in JavaScript. A lot of people are advocating doing everything in JavaScript because it gives you the most power, and perhaps improving the performance of JavaScript libraries using typed arrays, for example, so that we can get the performance we need for doing this kind of thing. Other people are saying that's too complicated for application developers. A simpler sort of node approach would work. I suspect there'll be some consensus in the middle. And Al McDonald is working on setting up a working group for this stuff as well. So yeah, I'd just like to thank the people who helped me put together the presentation and who I'm representing today, Al, Chris, Joe, David, Corbin, and everyone on the audio incubator team.
We have time for maybe one or two questions. Seeing none, Larry, can you get ready? No, go ahead. Go to the mic. We'll just get ready at the same time.
Perhaps I should say that this has nothing to do with Chevron, any kind of opinion on this. This is with my own hat on. It sort of seems to me that the music notation...
Could you actually identify yourself?
Roger Cutler from Chevron.
Not from Chevron.
Not from Chevron in this question or comment. That it's more in the... It sort of seems to me that it's more in the spirit of the web to go after the music notation rather than binary wave files or sample files, where it's just a bunch of samples, whereas, you know, there's centuries of experience in how music notation works and the information that's in there. You know, I think that's what you should be putting on the web.
So, sorry, in the demo that I showed you, I mean, I'm not speaking for the people who made it, but the markup is semantic, so... The markup, the score notation that you saw was using music XML, I believe, but the audio playbacks are turning that music notation into sound was done using the
API. That's very cool, but music XML doesn't seem to quite go as far as it might.
It's a good point. I think it's something that has come up a couple of times now, and I should probably take that back to the group and see if it's something that needs to be folded into our activities, I think.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, I've got a bird of a feather table as well at lunchtime,
yes.
If anyone wants.
So we'll move on to the fourth speaker in this panel, Larry Macinter.
So the abstract in the agenda shows me giving a talk, and I started to prepare this talk about future new directions for HTML and what ought to be in HTML 6 instead of 5.
Speak to the microphone, Larry.
Okay. Well, it was talking to Paul. But earlier, I heard the desire that we have some blood on the floor and in the conversation. So I prepared another talk of what I thought were some of the controversial issues around HTML that we weren't going to resolve in the HTML 5 timeframe, but that I thought were still open. So if you look at my slides, there is a three or four slides at the beginning of the talk that I started to put together, and I'm not going to go through them. You can read them. And instead, I thought, just in the spirit of humming, that I would try and characterize some of the issues that I think have embroiled the standards community in HTML5 in particular, and see if I could bring these up as polarizing statements, and where do you stand on these things. So I think originally I was going to ask for hums for which one you liked better. I get it if it's a pair of statements, but I think instead I'll have hums on which one you hate more. All right, so you know, and if you dislike both of them, you can hum on both. All right. So one of the issues is whether or not standards should match reality. I have two statements. Standards should match reality. Standards should try and lead reality. The standard should follow what some... And there's some alternatives here. And if you hate any of them, you can hate them all. But should match what some, most, the important, the open source implementations have implemented, are willing to implement in the very near future versus, you know, there should be some ideal and the standard should move you toward the ideal independently of what the past was. So how many hate A? Hum, loudly. How many hate B?
Oh, so the A's are in the majority in this particular case. They hate.
How many like A? Yeah, hum loud if you like A. How many like B?
Okay.
So let me just go through these. Maybe people are going to warm up.
Inconclusive, do you agree?
Well, you know, yeah. I think these are polarizing statements because they affect the standard in a critical way. People come to the standards organization with very different opinions about what we ought to be doing, and these differences of assumptions have caused lots of cross chatter. Reverse engineering. The cost of understanding what some other implementation has done in the past. The standard should reduce the reverse engineering cost in the future, say enough that anyone else who had to wouldn't have to do the reverse engineering themselves, versus matching this behavior isn't important and what existing content is out there and what IE6 did in quirks mode. This is some temporary artifact and the standard doesn't need to say anything about it. So how many hate A? Pum. How many hate B? Okay. How many hate them both? No. All right.
So the B's, I think the B's won that one.
Yeah. Precision.
Sorry?
Let's go on. I think the judgment about which one is
no,
more strongly held.
No, they don't like the double negative. So, So how many like A?
Like A.
How many like B? So when we ask the like question, we get inconclusive results. When we ask the negative question, we get somewhat more distinguished results. That's an interesting phenomenon. That's based on only two data points, I will point out. Yeah. Or four, sorry. All right, let's
precision.
Keep going, Larry.
I got 15 of these. Actually, I have 20. Standards should precisely specify behavior, give details of how to implement something compatible with what is currently deployed, sufficient that no user will complain that some implementation doesn't work the same, versus standards should be as loose as possible, specify the minimum to get some degree of interoperability, but that you really want to allow novel kinds of implementation and not have to specify exactly in detail. Yeah, so conformance should be used very rarely. So how many like A? Let's do positive. How many like B? How many don't like either?
No, right. The A's solidly have that one.
Right.
So apparently that's why you paid for your plane ticket to come here.
Right. Leading. Standards should lead the community, add exciting new features. New features should appear in the standard first. There's standards to follow innovation. Vendors should add stuff and let people experiment with it, and only after it's been shown that it's useful that then you add it to the standard. All right, how many like A? How many like B? How many hate?
Go ahead, sorry.
No, you go ahead.
I think the B's had that one.
All right. Extensibility. Non-standard extensions should be avoided. We should eliminate any non-standard extensions. Everybody's experience should be the same. Non-standard extensions are valuable. Innovation will come from competing non-standard extensions. Such extensions be encouraged even though they're not universally deployed. A, do you like A? Do you like B? All right. Do I need to do any more hums?
The B's have it. The non, what did you refer to it as?
The non-standard extensions.
Modularity is valuable. Specifying technology in smaller separate parts is beneficial. The ability to choose substats, the ability to independently evolve modules. Modularity is disruptive. Independent individual leads to divergence. Different vendors will choose different subsets. It's, there will be chaos because as, the available modules by one implementation will be different, and the independent evolution is really hard to control. You kind of want to keep evolution in step. A, hum yes if you love A. Hum yes if you love B.
The A's had that one, but by not as much as some of the previous ones.
Timely. Standards takes too long. It should move faster. Shipping the latest proposed features is a good way. A standard to implementation should be really fast. Taking years to finish the standard is okay. Encouraging users to deploy experimental extensions before they are completed will cause fragmentation. Not all experiments should succeed. A's? B's?
All right, so if I'm to judge here, the front row is disturbing my results.
I think
I won't identify who's in the front row.
My goal here
but
was...
But the IETF hummers in the front row have figured out how to do this.
Let's do it again. How many like A? You can raise your hand if you want.
Okay.
How many like B?
It's nearly like the A's are on my right side and the B's are on the left side. All right, I would say it's about equal.
Web authors, this one's very specifically to the web. Web authors ignore standards. Most individual authors, designers don't care what the standard says. They implement things according to what the browsers accept. And so there's kind of no point in writing things about what authors must do. Influencing authors is possible. Well, if you could get the authors would stick to standards if some popular browsers enforced new features to standard conforming content. Is this one clear? A, hum. B, hum.
Nearly unanimous for B.
Interesting. The always on committees. The web should continue to grow. Web standards committees should be always on. We're going to have HTML forever, allowing for rapid evolution. And the notion of version numbers for standards is kind of obsolete if there's new stuff all the time. Versus standards should be stable and continued innovation may be good for suppliers, but it is bad for standards, and evolution should be allowed by, but you know, really firm, fixed deadlines. All right? A? B?
Oh, I think the B's just decided issue 4 in the HTML working group by a small majority.
Open source. Open source implementation is crucial. Open source implementation is unnecessary. Allowing private extensions is harmful. All right, so how many like A? How many like B?
A by a small amount.
Browsers and the web. The web is first and foremost what browsers do, with maybe web applications as a secondary, versus other needs can dominate browser needs. So HTML for email, that you might want to change HTML in a way that worked for email better, even if it didn't affect browsers at all, or for archiving or publishing, you know, even if it's meaningless in the browser context. A, B,
4-1 for B.
Royalty free, avoid all patented technology. Patented technology has a place. This is not revisiting the patent policy itself, but whether or not anything that you eliminate JPEG. A. B. All right.
I don't think the B people want to be identified.
I think unless they get beat up.
I think the A's, if we did that one again, we might get a different result if we asked everyone to close their eyes and not listen to the people beside them.
Close
the A's
ears.
Obviously had that one.
All right. Forking this spec, having multiple specifications which offer different definitions for the same thing allows leading features to be widely known and implemented and allow groups to work around organizational bottlenecks. Forking the spec is harmful. Multiple specs which claim to define the same thing as a power trip. A. B.
The B's have that one.
Accessibility. Accessibility is one of many requirements, and it may be important, but only one of many sets of requirements to be traded off against others. Versus it is not an option. And ensuring those who deploy products that are be accessible it is mandatory before the W3C can endorse. A. B.
B has it on that one.
Architecture. Speaking from the tag, how am I doing for time?
It's now lunchtime.
Okay. So architecture is mainly theoretical.
All those that want to go to lunch?
Yeah, yes.
We're going to do one more.
This is my last one. Architecture is mainly theoretical domain of these old guys on the tag versus architectural. Architecture and consistency is crucial. A. B. Oh, thank you.
Maybe the B's by a little bit.
I had five more. DRM and privacy and voice, and I didn't write them out. JavaScript is broken. It's just, it's essential and stable. None of these are HTML5 issues, in my opinion. We got to get HTML5 out without solving any of these things. But I think all of them are HTML future issues, is that none of the resolution of these is crucial for this organization to come to some terms with where on this balance we're going to go. It's crucial for solving a lot of the stability issues and moving forward to new applications. And I don't think any of these are really irreconcilable. Some of them have to do with maybe you want two specs. Maybe you want a leading spec and a conservative spec. Maybe you need a... you can't solve these problems unless you acknowledge them. And that's really what I was trying to get out here is that there's clearly a lot of differences of opinion, and working it out is really important for us. Thank you.
Thank you, Larry. First microphone.
Jonas Eking from Mozilla. So I have to say, like, on every single one of these questions, the devil is real in the details. Like,
yes.
There is not a single one where A or B is a right answer. It all depends on how you do it, how much you do it, when you do it.
Yes. I went out of my way to try and be as obnoxious as I could on both of them. But, of course, given my own prejudices, I was more obnoxious on one than the other.
Yeah, I mean, I had comments on every single one of those slides.
Yes.
And I mean, if you want to go to the first one, or whichever one, but there is no clear answer. Like trying to lead versus being backwards compatible.
Yes.
It's great to lead. XHTML2 was a great success, in some senses, but it didn't take off because it wasn't backwards compatible enough.
Leading is the skill of getting people to follow.
Yes.
So if you do something and no one follows it, then you're not leading.
Right. So, it was a clear undertone of HTML5 issues in a lot of these things.
Yes.
And I don't think there's a single thing here where HTML5 has gone A or B. Everything has been somewhere in the middle on every single slide of this.
Isn't that the challenge of doing work at the W3C, trying to find the middle ground, the consensus?
Right. For sure.
Yeah. I agree with you completely that. That these are the polarized extremes of ongoing debates, and finding some way through them is what we have to do, and I just don't think they're all resolved.
I'm going to go to the next speaker, if I could, Jonas.
Yep. Noah Mendelson, not really affiliated, but chairing the tag. Somewhat in the same spirit, I wanted to say I was in some ways delighted with this and in some ways disappointed. Some of us saw a preview of this in our tag session. I think Larry has done a tremendous service by putting these out there as things to think about. But what I was disappointed about was it never occurred to me that we would vote on them in any form. Because I think that sets them up. And it is true that these have been the source of polarization in particular cases that really matter. But I would much rather see us look at this and say, you have given us all a really interesting list of things to think about. And in many cases, as the last commentator said, the answer will be either in the middle or that both seemingly, like yin and yang, that both simultaneously contradictory things matter. And that's important.
Yeah,
I would leave it there.
The reason for the hum was not so much to get the answer of what the group thought, but to make sure that everyone really thought about where they thought, where
right,
they said.
But then each time the chair, with respect, Paul, would say, I think the A's have it by 30%. And by the way, in many cases, both of us were humming for both of them.
It was for the benefit of the IRC participants.
Harry Halpin, W3C Edinburgh. So I think, while you did an excellent job presenting sort of dichotomies here, I think there's a sort of a false dichotomy going on, where it's possible, the dichotomies seem to be either the web standards bodies imagine wonderful new features, which maybe the end users probably may or may not care about, we put them in the spec, or the spec people basically have to deal with the current mess of the web and don't add wonderful new features. But would it be possible that there's a third option, which would be that once the current mess is cleaned up, which is kind of what is coming out of HTML5, that we can then add features that are driven by what users actually want. And we have some ideas about what that might be, things like social networking, identity in the browser, and all these things aren't covered under any of the presentations about HTML Next, but they're quite realistic and probably matter more to ordinary users than very abstract questions about modularity and whatnot. So I would be interested in feedback on that.
I really disagree with you. I think that the issues of modularity have to be addressed. We have to move from where we are and do something about it. And yes, it would be great if we could always just concentrate on new features and new business, but unfinished old business comes up and bites you, in uncomfortable places unless you deal with them.
Okay, I'm gonna end the debate there. Lunch is next door. The BOF table announcements, I believe, are probably still outside, probably to the left. And we are, sorry? Is the room secure? Is the web secure? So you should be your own judge of that, because you don't want to blame anybody if you make the wrong decision. And we're back here, I believe, at 2 o'clock. So enjoy your lunch, and I want to thank all the speakers on the panel.